The Home Show with Sinead Ryan on News Talk.
Hello and you're very welcome along to the Home Show podcast with me, Sinead Ryan. Coming up this week, we continue our series on architecture throughout the ages with Roisin Murphy, and we're looking this week at the arts and crafts movement. It was small but beautiful. The world's largest collection of cuckoo clocks goes on display in Waterford, and we are going to be chatting to expert and curator David Bowles. Cleaner extraordinaire Paige Hill of mother and daughter duo from Sage will be telling us about their new TV show Cleaning Up Ireland, and Jenny Sheehan will be on the B-Day. If you'd like to get in touch with us on the Home Show podcast, you can email us at any stage during the week at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You'll find me on X and on Instagram, and I know lots of you like to get in touch that way. And of course, you can listen back to any bits you missed, because all of our pods are now up on the Go Loud app. Now, I am welcoming back to the show this week our resident for the last few weeks and the next few weeks, hopefully, Roisin Murphy, the Home Show's favourite architect. And we've been talking about bygone eras in architecture. We started way back in the Georgian period, the Bridgerton era, and we're right up now in what is commonly known as the arts and crafts movement. And this is nothing to do with crayons and bits of paper and any of that stuff. It's a distinct period. So Edward, our friend from last week, Edward VII, is still on the throne, heading towards George, and before the abdicating Eddie. So that's the kind of period we're in. And we're leaning now into a style which, as we mentioned last week, Roisin, with the whole Edwardian period, really has the burgeoning middle class front and centre. It's accessible, it's cheaper to build, but now we're getting into a very pretty kind of area.
It's kind of the notion, and again, it comes to an extent, it's all a reaction to the Victorian period, and of the kind of industrialization of things, okay? So suddenly there were manufacturing things, and there was also the social mores brought in, okay? So there's a couple of things happening. And in Britain in particular, there was this movement which was all about handcraft, and it was birthed by Morris and Cole. Okay, they're too famous. You'll notice them in wallpapers. Mm. They birthed this idea that was handcrafted objects, so wallpapers, lamps, but that were distinctly made by hand. They had this idea that everything could be beautiful and fun. And Ruskin was still there.
And Tiffany was here as well, doing his beautiful lamps.
This is it. That's exactly what it was. So they were in love with all that was done by hand. Okay, but it also had, at the same time, and keep this in the back of your head, there was the birth of kind of the national identities. Okay, particularly in Ireland, the arts and crafts movement is associated with this idea of Irishness. And it was kind of a Celtic sort of, they romanticised the idea. So you see the cladder was introduced, Irish lace making the big foray. There was a lot happening in Cork with the Crawford, and they really started, the Irish crafts movement was born. And we had a particular interest in Irish craft, but in particular, we had a big thing with stained glass. So we have that. I bet you can guess who I'm talking about.
You're going to mention Harry Clarke at some point, yes. I'm certain of it. But it strikes me that this is right around the time where we are forging our own independent state.
Yes.
And I presume, like, there was this, how can we be different from Britain? You know, like, what can we do that's unique to us and right for us, while keeping kind of strength of this movement together?
Yes, and it was in place. It was actually birthed, it kind of linked in with the Art Nouveau movement. You can't distinguish them. So think about Mackintosh and his high back black lacquered chairs that are very still in and Thone, these guys, their furniture is still very much in evidence in bistros, and it was the birth of tea and coffee and all sorts of other activities. But there was that idea of the national movement. movement. So it was actually birthed in Hungary. And if you, yeah, in the Hungarian movement, and they had, you know, if you think of it's Grand Hotel Budapest was actually Hungarian.
Yeah.
Department store.
So
okay.
You're seeing all that gold kind of gilt and glass.
And Klimt and all of that. Okay. And a thing called a whiplash curve. I loved that so much.
I think I've won a couple of them myself.
Yeah, well, the menopausal architecture. It was so evocative as well. So we had this kind of, so the two of them were intertwined. So architecture intertwined with an arts and crafts movement that birthed, like if you go to, have you ever been to Paris? Of course you have. Well, you know the Hector Guimond, the beautiful substations.
Yes, yes.
Art Nouveau.
So they are stunning.
Stunning, okay. And then we have a guy called Horta in Belgium. And Belgium is the best place to go to see Art Nouveau, okay? That's who knew? It's like, and literally, they have 500 buildings kept of it. They're particularly proud of it. But again, it's that thing where it's so different to the kind of what we were, you know, the Victorian, the class, these movements that invaded countries.
Was it considered experimental at the time? Were they just kind of trying every style and seeing what people liked?
I think it was part of the arts and crafts movement. I think that's the interesting thing, where you can see that stained glass, if you look at the Harry Class, Clark windows in particular, they're so tall, so elegant and so beautiful, so intertwined with the architecture. Mm. So the idea that, you know, we would, we have 5% art that comes in at the end of a building project. Mm. But say something like Bewley's is built around, you know, we won't mention the war.
Just look at the glass windows. Whoever owns them.
But it is pivotal to that building, that idea that you come in and your life is transformed by these decorative pieces rather than the architecture. Yeah. So it's very much about the expression of the handcraft and the person. Now, we also had one guy, and I talked about this last week, where Edwin Lutyens, who was around in the Edwardian period, okay? And he would have been our big Edwardian architect at the time in Ireland. He was, he's really famous. He had big involvement in New Delhi and all. He was an incredible architect. But he would have been at that period. But the British really didn't get involved. You're not really seeing the same influence. And we were very influenced by England. So I think about the only real place that I could say that we have a kind of a proper expression of Art Nouveau in Ireland is the Guinness's swimming pools. You know, the Ivy Trust pool, where you'll see there's a little bit of kind of flourish at that entrance. You'll see there's a big curved window that's very suggestive of the opening, and a little bit in some of the there's a building as well on the Botanic that the old Players' Will that I was talking about. You can see a tiny bit of influence of the Art Nouveau movement in Ireland then, but we didn't preserve it.
We were still kind of in our box at that stage and conservative.
Well, conservative. Yeah. And like, Lutyens never got into it. He remained a classical. And there would have been a guy called Sean Rothery, who was an architectural historian who taught us in Bolton Street all those years ago. And he used to say, Edwin Lutyens, he was a modernist. Now, he did have modern principles, but there was other things that came with the kind of Art Nouveau period, which was the jewellery and the lamps and the kind of figurative expression.
Maybe it was a bit too much too soon for Ireland, you know, at that time.
I think we were too influenced by the Brits.
Yeah.
I think we and then we had, but for me, I think it was one of the most, I think if I could choose to be born in another period, it would be Art Nouveau. I know you're Art Deco. I know that's coming next week. We have a whole show for us.
It is all very beautiful. What strikes me, what's in my head, when we were talking about things like the Tiffany lamps and the William Morris wallpaper and the Colfax and all, it's the colour. And it
light.
Must be because we had the industrial machinery able to do these things. So they're available to us, and people were prepared to be a little bit brave, do you
think? Except that then they were all, everything had to be done by hand, which is why coal wallpaper is still so expensive, because they're wooden blocks. So the idea was that you made these wooden blocks, that you were moving away from the industrialization of the Victorian period. If you can imagine a factory arriving and steam engines, what it must have done to people's, like the city really was becoming a machine to live in as well. And there was there was all of that stuff being written. And, we had the love affair with the machine never went away. And people like Lutyens and Bauhaus and all these people were coming down the line, and they were really rejecting this kind of Art Nouveau movement. The other thing that's really worth having a look at is Eileen Gray's Tiger Che. She did a tiger chair, okay, and it's proper Art Nouveau piece where it looks like a devil. It has big, huge, round horns. It looks exactly like an animal, and it is the most expensive piece of furniture ever sold. So there you go. But it's all animal skills and luxury. It's quite sensuous because it's curvy. It's very feminine. Mm. And in architecture, there's always that, like Gaudi would be a big exponent of it as well. You know, he was a huge exemplar of it. But we don't really engage with that anymore. We might do a bit with Geary, but like there's such innovation possible now, I think, because of computers that we can kind of link into that period.
But it's one of those periods that you can spot straight away because it's so different from what went before and what came after.
No.
So that whole ability to travel, see what the Europeans were doing, trains were going across a state now. So people came back with ideas and notions about how things could be done.
And there was also, in Ireland as well, we had this, I suppose, there was the lace making happened. Mm. So there were certain things to do with the craft movement that were really bedded in. And it was a Gleason and White who set it up. And they really bedded in the idea of Irish craft as well. So we've a lot to be thankful for them in the respect that we have a very good craft tradition that has, that strand has kept all the way through when we were poor. And with the Catholic religion was getting bedded in, we had all the, you know, the robes. So all that lace making happened, which we don't see that much in terms of architecture, but it was hugely important in a way in terms of the arts and crafts movement. And Ireland was very poor. They made all these relief programs to elevate what they thought with the poor people by doing good works, which was, so that happened in lace making, weaving. We didn't have so much in the other things like rush making and things like that. That was still very much, that's part of our modern craft revival. But you can see where they kept certain crafts alive as well in this movement, in their good works. It was a short-lived period as well. It kind of wrapped up in...
Yeah, but what a legacy. I mean, really, really lovely stuff. And to me, when I think of arts and crafts, even though they're not, well, maybe you can tell me if they're linked or not. I didn't think they were. There's a kind of a slight Americanism about them. Those kind of wooden houses with the clapboard houses with the veranda around the side. And, you know, that comes into my... We didn't have that here and it wasn't in the States, but they were built in that time. They were Italians.
I'm not quite sure. I think it's more Victorian. They call them the Italianites if it's San Francisco anyway, and all those clapperboard houses.
Yeah. And that was such the burgeoning part of the world at that stage. So everything comes back with people, doesn't it?
Yeah.
People visiting and travelling and finding out new things.
Well, that's it. It was exactly that. It was, I suppose, the birth of airplane and that idea of movement and
other people are doing things differently
and
over
women
here.
Women as well. Women had arrived they had had the vote at this stage. So they had arrived, they didn't have the vote, they were establishing their presence, they're looking for a movement. So all of that plays into the Art Nouveau period.
All right. Well, that is Art and Crafts Movement, Art Nouveau. Do try and spot some of it when you're out and about, because there is precious little in Ireland, as you said, compared to the other periods, but it is there and you can see it.
And you can tag me on it because I'm very interested in this. I know there's a thing called, there's a house somewhere that was built in this century it's some house in the countryside, and it is Art Nouveau, and I don't exactly know where it is, but there's all these, it's abandoned house because there's no planning permission, built in the Art Nouveau style.
All right. Well, you can follow Roisin Murphy, architect, on Instagram.
Yeah.
And she will go and dig that out now put it up on her on her feed so you can all go in and have a look at it. All right. And next week, as I say, we will be covering my absolute favourite period in architecture ever. And yes, we will be devoting an entire segment to it. It's the Art Deco period. It's my show. I can do this. All right, Roisin, thanks a million once again for joining us.
See you next week.
The Home Show on News Talk. The Home Show on News Talk.
Now, a landmark exhibition showcasing 400 extraordinary and rare cuckoo clocks from Germany's Black Forest will be on display at Waterford's Irish Museum of Time. It's the largest collection of its kind on display anywhere in the world. And it has been generously acquired and curated by my guest, museum benefactor, David Bowles. And he joins me now. David, you're very welcome to the Home Show. I think we could probably all describe one, but why don't you tell us about the particular features of a cuckoo clock?
Well, they originally evolved in the Black Forest area in Germany, where there was very little work on the farms in the winter, cold winters. And somebody came up with the idea of producing a clock that would announce the hour by using the sound of a bird. And if you think of most birds, they don't make very distinct sounds. But a cuckoo magically repeats very definitely cuckoo, cuckoo at a very steady rate. So it was the perfect bird to pick to denote the striking of a clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock. So somebody worked this out way back, we don't know who, at a very early stage. Anyway, so that was, somebody came up with the idea and then it evolved. And they people who were making these were very poor. Metal was expensive. So they realized it was possible to make a clock without using very much metal, virtually none, of using timber instead. And there were masters at timber work and working with wood. So they managed to make all the wheels, is it with the teeth on them, purely out of timber, out of wood, using just the right timbers. And then they realized you have to make it attractive. So they devised sort of a case that would be looking a bit like a Black Forest scene with the cuckoo coming out, cuckooing, and then the surrounding frame would have various features, birds, animals, etc., carved into the frame. And then that's the way it started.
So there's something very rhythmic then in the cuckoo's call that alerted these people from bygone eras to say, do you know what, that actually sounds like a tick-tock or a very kind of resonant sound. So it was very clever to do that. And obviously that's where they get the name. Tell me why you became so fascinated with these timepieces, David.
Well, I actually, my father had a few interesting old clocks in the house. And as a teenager, 15 years of age, I became interested in them, in the fact that they were wonderfully complicated things, that you could take them apart, get them to go. And when they were going, a little bit like the beating of our hearts, they tick-tock away happily. And then I realized pocket watches were interesting. And I started collecting the odd clock at 15 years of age. Then I suddenly realized Irish clocks were fascinating, but nobody seemed to want to know anything about them. And that was my main interest, Irish clocks. And I gradually built up has turned out to be the largest, finest collection in the world, which are all in the Museum of the Irish Museum of Time in Waterford. The cuckoo clocks came much later. I had one in my bedroom growing up. But after the museum was set up, it turned out that two Polish brothers in England had started collecting cuckoo clocks once again as teenagers, and they had the finest collection in Britain and perhaps the finest, one of the finest in the world. And by chance, they were retiring, and the museum in Waterford was just there at the right time to acquire their entire collection. So that's how they ended up in Waterford.
Do you know how many clocks and timepieces you've owned over the years?
Oh, good question. I wouldn't know. I mean,
are we in the hundreds?
We would be in the region of 100 or more, right. Over 100 probably. When you say clocks and pocket watches, because I collect pocket watches as well. But one always starts to, when you haven't much money, you collect poor ones. Then you get a bit better off, you can collect better ones.
Indeed.
And then get rid of the poorer ones. That's the way collecting goes.
Yes, of course. And tell us about some of the more unusual examples that maybe people can see when they go down to this exhibit.
Well, the museum is in two parts. There's a beautiful old church, perfectly converted into a museum. And that was the original Irish Museum of Time. And that is mainly Irish clocks, but clocks from everywhere over the world, from Japan to Russia and Europe and so on. So that was the existing museum. And then the council acquired the building next door. And then the Black Forest cuckoo clock section is an entirely separate building. Mm-hmm. It's through a door from this bright museum into this mysterious forest-like environment with illuminated panels on the walls. It's all quite magical. And then the cuckoo clocks are all displayed there. And there's just endless variety. You couldn't know where to start describing them.
Now, I suppose if you go in at the top of the hour, are you going to be deafened with them all going off?
That's a good question. Not really. We have a number of clocks obviously going, many clocks going. But to keep them all precisely to time would be a nightmare. And so we've restricted the numbers to a reasonable number. But it's still impressive. It also has the advantage that different ones are striking at different times. So you can walk around and there'll be a clock striking somewhere, or cuckooing somewhere.
Cuckooing somewhere. It'll be like birdsong in the middle of the forest, which I presume is the intent of that. What was the decision to donate these or kind of curate them for the Museum of Time? Is it that you just said, look, I need to do something now permanent with these at this time in my life, or I want to be able to display, I don't have room for them and I need to be able to display them somewhere?
Well, I realised my collection was important way back many years ago, and I was hoping somewhere in Dublin would like to set up a little museum to acquire them or to display them and keep them. But I gave up. But luckily, Coleman Curran, who's a co-collector in the museum, and he is also the expert on Black Forest clocks compared to me, he and his wife was from Waterford, and luckily they met Eamon McEnany, the curator of Waterford Treasures, and his enthusiasm, his energy, his skills to work out how to display them was absolutely wonderful. And that immediately made me say, this is the place for my collection to end up. It was a perfect building, perfectly converted and managed by a wonderful architect, Rupert. And then Eamon was really the driving force who, I said, great, you can have them all.
It might be a bit now like asking you to pick your favourite child, David, but do you have a favourite among all the clocks?
I probably have several.
You can tell us.
It's been asked before. There's one very big, one of the grandfather clocks, by the way, technically are called long case clocks, in case people get confused. Grandfather clocks, long case clocks. And one of the largest grandfather clocks, Irish made, is in the museum. And it's very impressive. And the special thing about it is it was made about 1720, 1730, and it is absolutely immaculate, just the way it was made. It has magically survived from top to bottom. And not only that, it is very complicated. It plays street tunes. It has sort of evolving moon globe and days of the month. This is just a wonderful piece of furniture, apart from a wonderful piece of mechanism as well.
Indeed.
So it would be my favourite, I think. But there's many others.
I have always owned a watch, a wristwatch, because I couldn't imagine not having one and not being able to kind of check the time, which I'm sure I do several times a day. A lot of younger people now, David, a lot of people now are like, well, I have my phone. I don't need to wear a watch. I don't need to have this thing on my wrist. Does that make you kind of nostalgic or a little bit sad that maybe people won't carry this, you know, this tradition on into the future?
Not really, no, because first of all, the museum is mostly pre-wristwatches. There are wristwatches in it, but most of the watches are pocket watches. And it is possible to wear a pocket watch on a special event. It's very impressive to have a silver or a gold pocket watch on a chain and wear a waistcoat and take it out and look at the time, and everybody gets impressed. But they really are pieces that are meant to be admired rather than really carried around at this stage.
Yeah. And listen, the clocks go back now. In a few weeks, do you have to manually kind of wind these or forward? Eva's telling me it's forward. It goes. Do they all have to be manually wound now?
Oh yes. Well, apart from one or two electric clocks, every single clock in the museum has to be wound. And I mean, the pocket watch had to be wound every single day. And it's hard to believe that a pocket watch that's over 300 years old that was wound probably every day for 100, 200 years, and it still survives, carried around in a gentleman's pocket. It's astonishing that they survive having to be wound literally every day for a pocket watch and every week for every other clock, basically.
All right.
So they do need winding, all of them.
Indeed. Well, sturdy, if nothing else, for sure. OK, well, look, the Cuckoo Clock exhibition officially opens to the public on March 27th at the Irish Museum of Time. And you can find out more about that on www.waterfordtreasures.com. Curator, collector and expert David Bowles, thanks a million for joining us on The Home Show today. I'm definitely going to go in there at the top of the hour. No question about it. You want to walk into an entrance. David, thanks a million for joining us on The Home Show.
Thank you very much.
Cleaning Up Ireland is a new 8-part television series on Virgin Media that goes behind the scenes with the country's unsung heroes of hygiene. Joining me this afternoon is Paige Hill, one half of the mother-daughter duo from Sage Cleaning, based in Mallow, down in Cork. You'll be on our screens tomorrow, Paige. Tell us a little bit about the show.
We took part in the Cleaning Up Ireland series, and it was absolutely fantastic for every business and to showcase the work that all of us do behind the scenes to make sure that Ireland is clean, to make sure that the communities get the benefit of professional cleaning services. Our streets are clean, our homes are clean. And it's just such a privilege to show all the work that I think is kind of forgotten in the industry.
Mm. And so... So these episodes, and you're not in all of them, you're in a selection of them, you're following around, you've teamed up with Dublin City Council and looked at really the very, very important and hard work that mostly goes completely unnoticed by pedestrians and citizens. What kind of things did you tackle?
So for us, we predominantly tackled the housing, so residential. We had just full on deep cleans and just keeping the maintenance residential cleaning that we had on the show just to demonstrate the day to day busy working individuals that just do not have the time to keep on top of it or just prefer to spend their time doing their own personal and business related things as well. So for us, our time on the show was just demonstrating the impact that we have on keeping our homes in the communities clean.
Mm. Did you find you had even more respect for all the hard work that goes into it?
Do you know what? Yes, it kind of, when somebody comes to you and they say, do you know, you're actually doing such a good job, and you're like, I am, you kind of have to take a step back and kind of realize that you're actually making such a big difference and that you're working really hard every day to make an impact on everybody else, not just yourself. Like for us, we find it very satisfactory to deliver great cleaning results to all of our clients and cleaning services. But when you have people that shine a light on all the hard work that you bring and do, it's absolutely just fantastic just to feel the recognition for that.
How did you get started in this business?
So with my mom and I, we started Sage Cleaning Services in the middle of COVID. At the time, obviously, you know, the uncertainty was high and the focus was on health and safety everywhere. And we lived in the rural areas and we spoke to our neighbours who are all farmers and healthcare workers, and they were quite overlooked during the COVID region, you know, with the focus being on health and safety and them being out as first responders all the time. They just didn't. They weren't able to get professional cleaning services either in schools, hospitals, or in their own personal homes because most of the cleaning companies are in the city centre and they just don't travel out very far into the rural areas where your farmers and your nurses and your first aid responders are. So we, honestly, after speaking to our neighbours, we saw a gap in the market and we decided just to test it. We thought, let's test the waters and see how we can get on. And our first clients were actually our neighbours and a few local community schools and medical centres who needed their properties being sanitised and all that, just to make sure that everybody was being safe and everything was sanitised.
Mm. Now, your duo, your other business partner is Shan, who is your mum. What was it like working? What is it like working together? And what was it like working on the show together?
Do you know what is actually so amazing to work with my mom? We're more best friends than mom and daughter, to be quite honest with you. We do everything together, even though she's currently in South Africa at the moment and we phone every single day. I'm like, you won't believe the things that are going on. But working with my mom, you can imagine working with family naturally has some obstacles and some disagreements. But because we have just such a good relationship and we have boundaries in place, especially when it comes to a professional and a personal relationship, having the business together. In the beginning, we had to create clear boundaries and lines to, you know, make sure that nobody's overstepping. But overall, I absolutely love working with my mom.
I suppose we can all say we learned how to clean from our mothers, you know, because in the same way that very often they're the first people who teach us how to cook, how to look after ourselves and all that. So would you say she has the higher standards, or is she somebody saying, no, do it this way, do it like this?
Honestly, I would say it's the other way around. I would say my mom definitely taught me how to clean. We were very cleanly growing up. I did get plenty of reprimands about cleaning my room growing up, but you know, that's every adolescent at this point. But I would say in the business, I have a bit of a, I like things to be perfect, almost in the sense of everything has to have a place, everything needs to be done to a certain degree. So whilst she did teach me the cleaning, I think it's more the other way around. If something were to be a bit out of place, I would be more the one that's bringing
something
up.
All right. Well, of course, it's Mother's Day now next weekend. So you'll be hopefully giving her the day off and from a little bit of cleaning. Now, a lot of listeners will remember cleaning shows. You know, I mean, the fact that you can go on the television and have a show about cleaning, probably says something about us. But from the UK back in the 90s, like How Clean Is Your House with Kim Woodburn and Aggie McKenzie, or Obsessive Compulsive Cleaners on Channel 4. Why is it, do you think, from your experience, Paige, that some people allow their homes to become so untidy and messy that they need experts in?
You know, that's such a good question. And I, truthfully, being in this for about 5.5 years now, we get to see so many properties and so many different circumstances. And with us working with social workers now as well, you know, and hospitals, I, for the most part, would say that life honestly is so tiring. Life is super busy for everybody. If you're not trying to juggle a 9-to-5, you're juggling getting your affairs in order, your kids, your work-life balance as well. And I think sometimes it just slips away from you. You procrastinate. Oh, I'll do the dishes tomorrow. Oh, I'll fold the laundry the next day. And the next day you say the same thing. And so day after day after day, you're kind of just procrastinating the tasks that are probably vital for the well-being of your family and the environment of your home. And I think people just overlook that. And then it gets too much of a burden for them that they feel like they can't even tackle it because it's too much of a tackle at this point because it's been put off for so long or maybe overlooked for so long. And overlooked can be maybe a health or a, you know, health or a mental disability or anything like that as well. Do you know, like people are very vulnerable as well with these things. And so that's why we come into it and we can make sure that their homes are decluttered and their homes are freshened up and hygienic for them to be welcomed back to a warm, clean home.
Now, we know, you know, from mental health professionals that hoarding and people who have a compulsive or obsessive disorder to hoard items that most of us, let's be honest, would consider just rubbish. But I presume it means in your business that when you're approaching people like that with mental health difficulties, that you have to be even more kind of empathetic and careful around that, because it seems to me a lot of those people, they don't want their house cleared out because the stuff is providing some kind of anxiety alleviating process for them.
It's so true. We've actually recently been back to back with deep cleaning and hoarding for our patients. Basically, these patients are in hospital, they need to come back home, but obviously they're not allowed to come back home because of the condition of their homes. And this is where this falls into place, because these are the types of patients where they do have everything. And for us, you'll probably see a newspaper article from 1979 and you think, oh, that needs to go in the dustbin. And they're like, no. You cannot throw that away because there's an article on the fourth page. And they are like that. And you would be so surprised to think that their memory about what they know and where they put certain items, they don't want to feel the detachment from things that surround them on a day-to-day basis. Kind of like, it's like a comfort. And for the most part, they genuinely don't like to see bags of their belongings or things that we would consider as waste being thrown out. And so sometimes it can, you just have to sit there and honestly, you have to just sit there with them and just say to them, listen, do you really need this? Or if you want to, can I put it away somewhere else? But, you know, some of the things you really don't need to be keeping.
It must be a very difficult conversation to have, because I imagine there's a tipping point between, you know, just hoarding newspaper and whatever else, you know, stuff that you have around you, boxes and bags and things. There must be a tipping point where it becomes unhygienic. And that can lead, of course, to other issues like vermin and food waste and things like that. Have you seen that in your practice?
Yes, we do. It's quite often that we come across these things, obviously, just because you have rooms that you cannot even see the floor, and food that's left out and just disregarded items that pay no attention to it. So we do come across rodents and vermin and all that quite frequently.
All right. Well, maybe getting in, professionals is the way to go of all kinds. Paige, listen, I wish you the best of luck with the series. It sounds absolutely fascinating. Cleaning Up Ireland is on at 8:30. The series is on now, but your episode is on tomorrow. 8:30 on Sundays on Virgin Media Play and Virgin Media One. And Paige is one half of the duo of Sage Cleaning. Thanks a million for joining us on The Home Show, Paige.
The Home Show on News Talk. The Home Show on News Talk.
Now, if you've ever been on holiday in Italy or Greece or further afield, maybe like Turkey or the Middle East, chances are you have found a bidet in your hotel bathroom. Now, it's very rare to see them, or rarer to see them, in Irish hotels and homes. But are we missing out? Well, here to tell us a little bit more about bidet etiquette is Home Show regular Jennifer Sheehan. Jenny, welcome back to The Home Show. Let's begin with the why. Why?
Why would we want not? One of
these? Do we not all have the same, and apologies now to listeners out there, the same toileting requirements and etiquette?
No, we are in the dark ages. I mean, I don't know why we can't get our act together and clean it up, but I really think we're in the dark ages. So this hit me when I first travelled to countries on the Arab Peninsula, or especially to Thailand, where they have much cleaner practices with bidet hoses beside the toilets, but especially when I was in South Korea last year. And that is, it's like travelling into the future. I mean, it's a joy to go to the bathroom.
Okay, but like that's why we have like Andrex.
Okay, so Andrex
is an option. The difference, right?
The difference being, and the common analogy is, if you got chocolate on your arm or if you got dirt in your arm, would you wipe it off with a tissue and call it done? Probably not.
Stop.
So it's much cleaner. It's much, much, much cleaner. It's much better for the environment because you're producing much less toilet paper, which is actually quite water intensive.
Right. Okay.
And it's better for our plumbing system, which is a little bit outdated. You know, we've had pipes under the ground for a long time, so not clogging them up with toilet paper would be beneficial. And I'll go back to saying it's cleaner.
Mm. Without being too graphic,
right?
Give us an explainer on how one ought to use it, because I know there was a not very stellar period in interior decor around the early 80s.
Yes.
When we had the avocado bathrooms and the pink bathrooms. And I know you're a bit of a fan and that's okay. But bidets suddenly started appearing in Irish bathrooms. And I'm not sure they were A, ever used, or B, people knew how to use them. And there was an early generation of tourists, maybe at the end of the 70s, coming into the 80s, when flights suddenly became more accessible. And people thought, maybe they're for washing your feet when you come in.
That's what I thought whenever I came across them in bathrooms. And I think the setup and the mechanism of those was quite difficult to use, because it was just a little downward pouring tap, wasn't it? With no directional nozzle.
Pan.
Just a pan.
You could just put your foot in and just give it a little wash. But
and so they weren't great, because they took up too much footprint in your toilet as well. And they have to be plumbed separately. And it's a big deal to put one of those in. And they're just not that used, and they're not that useful. So they're not great. So there's a few different types of bidets that are really, really helpful. So we'll start at the easiest one, let's say. And these are just the bidet hoses. You might edit this out. People call them bum guns. So these are super simple to install. You can buy them in Ireland.
I think the listener is a sturdy enough specimen that they can hear that word and get what you mean.
I'm sure you've all heard it before.
Right.
So these are very, very simple hoses that you can attach into your existing toilet plumbing. They sit very nicely beside your toilet. You can get beautiful looking ones that maybe match your existing hardware in your bathroom. Maybe you have brushed brass or some nice, you know, black fittings, whatever it might be. You can get those these hoses to match those. And these just sit beside your toilet. They have a little nozzle that turns on and you can spray yourself clean and be done with your day.
Okay, well, that explains a lot, because you sent us in pictures of this. And I looked at it immediately and I said, I can see the hose and I can't see the bidet.
So it really just looks like a shower hose.
Yeah.
If you have one of those separate
but
shower
you're
fittings.
You're on your own toilet pan when you're using them. You're not switching over to another piece of infrastructure.
No, you'd use your existing toilet and away you go. Yeah.
Okay. So it's like a little hose.
Like a little hose.
Okay.
And so that's lovely. You can also then get B-Day toilet seats. So these are little devices that attach underneath your toilet seat. So you would have to replace your existing toilet seat because a little mechanism needs to sit into the back of it. And you can have little controls down the side of your toilet seat to change the direction of the little nozzle that sits under that.
I'm really trying to hold it together here.
You press a little button and you can clean yourself. Yeah. So it's a little jet of water, you know, it's attached permanently kind of at the back of your toilet, pointing in various directions that you can control.
Okay, never get one of these if you've small children in your house. That's just my go-to top tip there. This is grown-up stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But it's just water. It's only water. Okay. I mean, how much harm can they do? You know, if your bathroom is tanked, away you go. Go for it.
All right. Now, do you think that it requires a little bit of practice?
Yeah, I think it does, because you are going to end up spraying yourself a little bit and there is going to be probably droplets going all over the place. So, you know, that little system, the second one I described there, where it's the existing little hose, that's just a press of a button and you can't go too far wrong if you're sitting there.
You just said it saves on toilet paper. Like, you're going to be using the toilet paper anyway, aren't
you? Well, not if you get one of the very fancy Japanese toilets. So you will have to dry yourself. So that could be toilet paper. You can choose to do that however you want.
Some countries, the culture is to use a little towel, like a little hand.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd be on board with that myself.
The laundry.
Now. Yeah.
The washing machine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Days of this stuff. Yeah. No, thank you.
No, that's a bit much for me.
Okay, so we're talking about hair dryers now, are we?
We're talking about hair dryers now. These are, you can buy, other countries have the toilet seat replacement that I was talking about. In other countries, you can get electric versions of these that are heated, that have little dryers built into them.
It's like
divine.
Japanese loo, because we've covered that before.
And theoretically, you can get that in Ireland, but not really, because we are super strict on the electrics that you can put into bathrooms in Ireland. So you would have to get on a separate circuit and all that kind of stuff. Mm. And it's next to impossible. But those toilets, those Japanese toilets, I mean, what an experience. It's a delight. And if you are in, you know, that part of Asia and Japan and South Korea, you'll see it advertised on hotel listings. Like, we would have thread count, the types of toilets that they have available in your hotel room, because it's so nice. So these are heated, they light up, they have mechanisms where the seat will open, some of them will play music and welcome you and calm you. There are scents available to be deployed at your will. You can choose the temperature of the water, and then crucially, they do have a drying system built in to them when you're finished.
You're not helping my very first question, which is why. But I know that.
Am I not answering with why not? Does this not sound amazing?
Heated seats, music, flushing, showers, all that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You can go really, really high spec, really, really high end. Now, you wouldn't because of price. I mean,
okay, so let's go there then. Right, let's start with that. Because let's stay in Ireland. And are there outlets selling this stuff?
Yeah, so Tile Style have them. Okay. Fair play, Tile Style. They've been quite ahead of the game. And I will say, because I looked, right, when I really wanted one of these when I came home from a holiday somewhere, and I was doing up my house, and I bought, the only one I could find was from abroad, and the fittings didn't quite fit the Irish toilet, and I had to do a bit of jerry rigging there, so it was a bit annoying. But the range that's available now is much, 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 much greater. So you can get them in Ireland. If you want to get the hose, we were talking about 20 to 40 quid, very, very simple. You can get them anywhere. Tile Style has them, Screwfix, Lenehan's, hardware shops, go for it. Okay. Just make sure you check the fitting size and it fits. If you want to get that electric B-Day seat, you can get them. I haven't found anywhere in Ireland that does it, so I think I would just leave that one go. If you want to go full hog, if you want to go for that full spa experience and you want the bells and whistles, Tile Style have the OG, the Toto, Japanese wash toilet. There's a Gerberit version to AquaClean, it's called, and Grow have one called Sensia, and they're all beautiful, and they are setting you back around the $4,000 to $5,000 mark. Now, you really need to get an electrician in. You cannot install these yourself. You have to have it certified by a registered electrician if you're putting in the electronics.
Well, if you're spending that amount, you know, you're not going to start kind of doing DIY over the weekend with that. All right. Do you see that there is a future for this type of toilet etiquette in Ireland. Is this where we are headed, or is it just still a bit of a novelty?
I don't know. I would hope so. So in parts of Europe, so Italy, for example, it's actually the law. You have to have a bidet in at least one toilet in all new builds. Now, it doesn't have to be a separate standalone bidet. It can be the bidet hose that we spoke about or built into the toilet seat. But it is mandatory. And, you know, adoption has been huge there. Countries that do have, like Japan, that pioneered that Toto toilet, the wash toilet, it's about 98% adoption there. They have a huge wow. widespread adoption. It's only about 2% in most of the rest of the Western world. So we've a lot of catching up to do. But I think with people traveling and seeing the benefits, I think as we become more multicultural and people bring their better, cleaner habits here, if you ask me, I think it will become more widespread.
Yeah, I must say, I mean, I'll be honest, and I'd be interested in what listeners have to say. So do get in touch with us with your own experience, 53106. And folks, if you still have avocado green bidet from 45 years ago, send us in a picture. Let's all have a look
at it. Let us know how to use it.
Maybe it's got a flower arrangement in it or... extra towels, or you're using it as a table. That's fine. That's okay. We're all for innovation. Jenny Sheehan at Workers Cottage on Instagram, if you want to look up Jenny and all of her doings there. Possibly not. Although this is the same person, by the way, folks, who has a disco ball in her bathroom.
I'm so all about the bathroom experience.
There you go. There you go. All right. That's all we have time for this week on our, well, it has to be said, eclectic home show. We've covered everything from cuckoo clocks to bidets. And that's all we have time for this week. Hope you enjoyed our mix of items on the home show. It was eclectic as ever. If you'd like to get in touch with us, it's thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You'll find me on Insta and on X. And any bits you missed, of course, all up where you got this one on the Go Loud app. Thanks to producer Aoife Breen. Stephen McLoone was on sound. We will be back here next week with another episode. Why don't you like and subscribe for free so you don't miss an episode. And you know what? If you like what we do and you like the show, why not rate us? We would be thrilled if you did that. I'll see you next week with a new episode, and have a fantastic week.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan. Saturday at 5 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.